He was making a new Wheatley. He had settlements everywhere, families everywhere. She had only one, and he was taking it. He had taken her from one people and driven her from another, and now he was casually reaching out to strip her of a third. And she was wrong. She could live on and have nothing. She would. He would see to it. Chapter 12 Anyanwu had never watched a group like her own break apart. She did not know whether there had ever before been a group like her own. Certainly, once Doro began to spend time at the plantation, exercising his authority as he chose, while Anyanwu stood by and said nothing, the character of the group began to change. When he brought Joseph Toller as husband for one of Anyanwu's daughters, the young man changed the group more by refusing to do work of any kind. His foster parents had pampered him, allowed him to spend his time drinking and gambling and betting young women. But he was a beautiful young man, honey-colored with curly black hair, tall and slender. Anyanwu's daughter, Margaret Necka, was fascinated by him. She accepted him very quickly. Few other people on the plantation accepted him at all. He was not doing his share of the work, yet he could not be fired and sent away. He could, however, make a great deal of trouble. He had been on the plantation for only a few weeks when he went too far and lost a fist fight with Anyanwu's son, Stephen. Anyanwu was alone when Stephen came to tell her what had happened. She had just come from treating a 4-year-old who had wandered down to the bayou and surprised a water moccasin. She had been able to manufacture within her own body a medicine to counter the poison easily, since one of the first things she had done on settling in Louisiana was allow herself to be bitten by such a snake. By now, countering the poison was almost second nature to her. She did like to have a meal afterward, though. Thus Stephen, bruised and disheveled, found her in the dining room, eating.
"You got to get rid of that lazy, worthless bastard," he said.
Anyanwu sighed. There was no need to ask who the boy meant.
"What has he done?"
"Tried to rape Helen."
Anyanwu dropped the piece of cornbread she had been about to bite. Helen was her youngest daughter, 11 years old.
"He what?"
"I caught them in the Duran cabin. He was tearing her clothes off."
"Is she all right?"
"Yes. She's in her room."
Anyanwu stood up.
"I'll see her in a little while, then."
"Where is he?"
"Lying in front of the Duran cabin."
She went out, not knowing whether she was going to give the young man another beating or help him if Stephen had hurt him seriously. But what kind of animal was he to try to rape a child? How could Anyanwu possibly tolerate him here after this? Doro would have to take him away, breeding be damned. The young man was not beautiful when Anyanwu found him. He was half again as large as Stephen and strong in spite of his indolence, but Stephen had inherited much of Anyanwu's strength, and he knew how to administer a good beating, even with his tender, newly finished arms and hands. The young man's face was a lumpy mass of bruised tissue. His nose was broken and bleeding. The flesh around his eyes was grotesquely swollen. The left ear was torn nearly off. He would lose it and look like one of the slaves marked and sold south for running away. His body was so bruised beneath his shirt that Anyanwu was certain he had broken ribs, and he was lacking several of his front teeth. He would never be beautiful again. He began to come to as Anyanwu was probing at his ribs. He grunted, cursed, coughed, and with the cough, twisted in agony.
"Be still," Anyanwu said.
"Breathe shallowly, and try not to cough any more."
The young man whimpered.
"Be thankful Stephen caught you," she said.
"If it had been me, you would take no more interest in women, I promise you, not for the rest of your life."
In spite of his pain, the young man cringed away from her, clutching himself protectively.
"What can there be in you worth inflicting on descendants?"
she asked in disgust. She made him stand up, ignoring his weakness, his moans of pain.
"Now get into the house," she said, "or go lie in the barn with the other animals."
He made it into the house, did not pass out until he reached the stairs. Anyanwu carried him up to a small, hot attic bedroom, washed him, bandaged his ribs, and left him there with water, bread, and a little fruit. She could have given him something to ease his pain, but she did not. The little girl, Helen, lay asleep on her bed, still wearing her torn dress. Her face was swollen on one side, as though from a heavy blow, and the sight of it made Anyanwu want to give the young man another beating. Instead, she woke the child, gently. In spite of her gentleness, Helen awoke with a start and cried out.
"You are safe," Anyanwu told her. "I'm here."
The child clung to her, not weeping, only holding tightly, holding with all her strength.
"Are you hurt?" Anyanwu asked. "Did he hurt you?"
The girl did not respond.
"Ubiageli, are you hurt?"
The girl lay down again slowly and looked up at her.
"He came into my thoughts," she said. "I could feel him come in."
"Into your thoughts?"
"I could feel it. I knew it was him. He wanted me to go to Tina Duran's house."
"He made you go?"
"I don't know."
Finally, the child began to cry. She pulled her pillow around her swollen face and wept into it. Anyanwu rubbed her shoulders and her neck and let her cry. She did not think the girl was crying because she had nearly been raped.
"Ubiageli," she whispered.
Before the girl's birth, a childless white woman named Helen Matthews had asked Anyanwu to give a child her name. Anyanwu had never liked the name Helen, but the white woman had been a good friend, one of those who had overcome her own upbringing and her neighbors' noisy mouths and come to live on the plantation. She had never been able to have children, had been past the age of bearing when she met Anyanwu. Thus, Anyanwu's youngest daughter was named Helen. And Helen was the daughter Anyanwu most often called by her second name, Ubiageli. Somehow, she had lost that custom with the others.
"Ubiageli, tell me all that he did."
After a while, the girl sniffed, turned over, and wiped her face. She lay still, staring up at the ceiling, one small frown between her eyes.
"I was getting water," she said. "I wanted to help Rita."
This was the Os Rouge cook, a woman of black and Indian ancestry and Spanish appearance.
"She needed water, so I was at the well. He came to talk to me. He said I was pretty. He said he liked little girls. He said he had liked me for a long time."
"I should have thrown him into the pigsty,"
muttered Anyanwu.
"Let his body wallow in shit, so that it could be fit for his mind."
"I tried to go take the water to Rita,"
the girl continued.
"But he told me to come with him. I went. I didn't like to go, but I could feel him in my thoughts. Then I was away from myself, someplace else watching myself walk with him. I tried to turn back, but I couldn't. My legs were walking without me."
She stopped, looked at Anyanwu.
"I never knew if Stephen was looking into my thoughts."
"But Stephen can only look,"
Anyanwu said.
"He can't make you do anything."
"He wouldn't anyway. No."
Eyes downcast, the girl continued.
"We went into Tina's cabin and he was closing the door when I found I could move my legs again. I ran out the door before he could get it shut. Then he took back my legs and I screamed and fell. I thought he would make me walk back, but he came out and grabbed me and dragged me back. I think that was when Stephen saw us."
She looked up.
Did Stephen kill him?
No. Anyanwu shuddered, not wanting to think of what Doro might have done to Stephen if Stephen had killed the worthless Joseph. If there had to be killing, she must do it. Probably no one on the plantation disliked killing more than she did, but she had to protect her people from both Doro's malicious strangers and Doro himself. Still, she hoped Joseph would behave himself until Doro returned and took him away.
"Stephen should have killed him,"
Helen said softly.
"Now, maybe he'll make my legs move again, or maybe he'll do something worse."
She shook her head, her child's face hard and old. Anyanwu took her hand, remembering Lael, her Isaac's unlikely, unworthy brother. In all her time with Doro, she had not met another of his people as determinedly vicious as Lael. Until now, perhaps. Why had Doro given her such a man? And why had he not at least warned her?
"What will you do with him?"
the girl asked.
"Have Doro take him away." "Will Doro do that? Just because you say so?"
Anyanwu winced. "Just because you say so." How long had things been going on the plantation, just because she said so? People had been content with what she said. If they had problems they could not solve, they came to her. If they quarreled and could not settle matters themselves, they came to her. She had never invited them to come to her with their troubles, but she had never turned them away, either. They had made her their final authority. Now, her 11-year-old daughter wanted to know if a thing would happen just because she said so. Her 11-year-old. It had taken time, patience, and at least some wisdom to build the people's confidence in her. It took only a few weeks of Doro's presence to erode that confidence so badly that even her children doubted her.
"Will Doro take him away?"
the girl persisted. "Yes," Anyanwu said quietly. "I will see to it." That night, Stephen walked in his sleep for the first time in his life. He walked out into the upper gallery of the porch and fell, or jumped off. There was no disturbance. Stephen did not cry out. At dawn, old Louisa found him sprawled on the ground, his neck so twisted that Louisa was not surprised to find his body cold. The old woman climbed the stairs herself to wake Anyanwu and take her to an upstairs sitting room away from the young daughter, who was sleeping with her. The daughter, Helen, slept on, content, moving over a little into the warm place Anyanwu had left. In the sitting room, Louisa stood hesitant, silent before Anyanwu, longing for a way to ease the terrible news. Anyanwu did not know how she was loved, Louisa thought. She gathered people to her and cared for them and helped them care for each other. Louisa had a sensitivity that made closeness with other people a torture to her for most of her life. Somehow, she had endured a childhood and adolescence on a true plantation, where the ordinary accepted cruelties of slaveholder to slave drove her away into a marriage that she should not have made. People thought she was merely kind and womanishly unrealistic to be in such sympathy with slaves. They did not understand that far too much of the time, she literally felt what the slaves felt, shared fragments of their meager pleasure and far too many fragments of their pain. She had had none of Stephen's control, had never completed the agonizing change that she knew had come to the young man 2 years before. The man thing called Doro had told her this was because her ancestry was wrong. He said she was descended from his people. It was his fault, then, that she had lived her life knowing of her husband's contempt and her children's indifference. It was his fault that she had been 60 years old before she found people whose presence she could endure without pain. People she could love and be loved by. She was grandmother to all the children here. Some of them actually lived in her cabin because their parents could not, or would not, care for them. Louisa thought some parents were too sensitive to any negative or rebellious feelings in their children.
Anyanwu thought it was more than that. That some people did not want any children around them, rebellious or not. She said some of Doro's people were that way. Anyanwu took in stray children herself, as well as stray adults. Her son had shown signs of becoming much like her. Now, that son was dead.
"What is it?"
Anyanwu asked her.
"What has happened?"
"An accident," Louisa said, longing to spare her.
"Is it Joseph?"
"Joseph?" That son of a whore Doro had brought to marry one of Anyanwu's daughters.
Would I care if it were Joseph?
"Who then? Tell me, Louisa."
The old woman took a deep breath.
"Your son," she said. "Stephen is dead."
There was a long, terrible silence. Anyanwu sat frozen, stunned. Louisa wished she could wail with a mother's grief so that Louisa could comfort her, but Anyanwu never wailed.
"How could he die?"
Anyanwu whispered.
"He was 19. He was a healer. How could he die?"
"I don't know. He fell."
"From where?"
"Upstairs. From the gallery."
"But how? Why?"
"How can I know, Anyanwu? It happened last night. It must have. I only found him a few moments ago.
Show me."
She would have gone down in her gown, but Louisa seized a cloak from her bedroom and wrapped her in it. She noticed as she left with Anyanwu that the little girl was moving restlessly in her sleep, moaning softly. A nightmare? Outside, others had discovered Stephen's body. Two children stood back, staring at him wide-eyed, and a woman knelt beside him wailing, as Anyanwu would not. The woman was Aiye, a tall, handsome, solemn woman of utterly confused ancestry. French and African, Spanish and Indian. The mixture blended all too well in her. Louisa knew her to have 36 years, but she could have passed easily for a woman of 26, or even younger. The children were her son and daughter, and the one in her belly would be Stephen's son or daughter. She had married a husband who loved wine better than he could love any woman, and wine had finally killed him. Anyanwu had found her destitute with two babies, selling herself to get food for them, and considering very seriously whether she should take her husband's rusty knife and cut their throats, and then her own. Anyanwu had given her a home and hope. Stephen, when he was old enough, had given her something more. Louisa could remember Anyanwu shaking her head over the match, saying,
"She is like a bitch in heat around him. You would never know from her behavior that she could be his mother."
And Louisa had laughed.
"You should hear yourself, Anyanwu. Better yet, you should see yourself when you find a man that you want."
"I am not like that."
Anyanwu had been indignant.
"Of course not. You are very much better and very much older."
And Anyanwu, being Anyanwu, had gone from angry silence to easy laughter.
"No doubt he will be a better husband some day for having known her," she said.
"Or perhaps he will surprise you and marry her,"
Louisa countered.
"Despite their ages, there is more than the ordinary pull between them. She is like him. She has some of what he has, some of the power. She cannot use it, but it is there. I can feel it in her sometimes, especially in those times when she is hottest after him."
Anyanwu had ignored this, preferring to believe that eventually her son would make a suitable marriage. Even now, Louisa did not know whether Anyanwu knew of the child coming. There was nothing showing yet, but Iye had told Louisa. She would not have told Anyanwu. Now, Anyanwu went to the body, bent to touch the cold flesh of the throat. Iye saw her and started to move away, but Anyanwu caught her hand.
"We both mourn,"
she said softly. Iye hid her face and continued to weep. It was her youngest child, a boy of 8 years, whose scream stopped both her crying and Anyanwu's more silent grief. At the boy's cry, everyone looked at him, then upward at the gallery where he was looking. There, Helen was slowly climbing over the railing. Instantly, Anyanwu moved. Louisa had never seen a human being move that quickly. When Helen jumped, Anyanwu was in position beneath her. Anyanwu caught her in a careful, cushioning fashion, so that even though the girl had dived off the railing head first, her head did not strike the ground. Neither her head nor her neck were injured. She was almost as large as Anyanwu, but Anyanwu was clearly not troubled by her size or weight. By the time Louisa realized what was happening, it was over. Anyanwu was calming her weeping daughter.
"Why did she do it?"
Louisa asked.
"What is happening?"
Anyanwu shook her head, clearly frightened, bewildered.
"It was Joseph,"
Helen said at last.
"He moved my legs again. I thought it was only a dream until..."
She looked up at the gallery, then at her mother, who still held her. She began to cry again.
"Obiageli,"
Anyanwu said.
"Stay here with Louisa. Stay here. I'm going up to see him."
But the child clung to Anyanwu and screamed when Louisa tried to pry her loose. Anyanwu could have pried her loose easily, but she chose to spend a few moments more comforting her. When Helen was calmer, it was Iye, not Louisa, who took her.
"Keep her with you," Anyanwu said. "Don't let her go into the house. Don't let anyone in."
"What will you do?"
Iye asked. Anyanwu did not answer. Her body had already begun to change. She threw off her cloak and her gown. By the time she was naked, her body was clearly no longer human. She was changing very quickly, becoming a great cat this time instead of the familiar large dog. A great spotted cat. When the change was complete, she went to the door, and Louisa opened it for her. Louisa started to follow her in. There would be at least one other door that needed opening, after all. But the cat turned and uttered a large, coughing cry. It barred Louisa's path until she turned and went outside again.
"My God," whispered Iye as Louisa returned. "I'm never afraid of her until she does something like that right in front of me."
Louisa ignored her, went to Stephen, and straightened his neck and body, then covered him with Anyanwu's discarded cloak.
"What's she gonna do?"
Iye asked.
"Kill Joseph?"
Helen said, gently.
"Kill?"
Iye stared uncomprehending into the small, solemn face.
"Yes,"
the child said.
"And she ought to kill Doro, too, before he brings us somebody worse."
In leopard form, Anyanwu padded down the hall and up the main stairs, then up the narrower stairs to the attic. She was hungry. She had changed a little too quickly, and she knew she would have to eat soon. She would control herself, though. She would eat none of Joseph's disgusting flesh. Better to eat stinking meat crawling with maggots. How could even Doro have brought her human vermin like Joseph? His door was shut, but Anyanwu opened it with a single blow of her paw. There was a hoarse sound of surprise from inside. Then, as she bounded into the room, something plucked at her forelegs, and she went sliding on chin and chest to jam her face against his washstand. It hurt, but she could ignore the pain. What she could not ignore was the fear. She had hoped to surprise him, catch him before he could use his ability. She had even hoped that he could not stop her while she was in a non-human form. Now she gave her tearing, coughing roar of anger and of fear that she might fail. For an instant, her legs were free. Perhaps she had frightened him into losing control. It did not matter. She leaped, claws extended, as though to the back of a running deer. Joseph screamed and threw his arms up to shield his throat. At the same moment, he controlled her legs again. He was inhumanly quick in his desperation. Anyanwu knew that because she was inhumanly quick all the time. Sensation left her legs, and she almost toppled off him. She seized a hold with her teeth, sinking them into one of his arms, tearing away flesh, meaning to get at the throat. Feeling returned to her legs, but suddenly she could not breathe. Her throat felt closed, blocked somehow. Instantly, she located the blockage, opened a place beneath it, a hole in her throat through which to breathe. And she got his throat between her teeth. Utterly desperate, he jammed his fingers in the newly made breathing hole. At another time, with other prey, she might have collapsed at the sudden, raw agony. But now, the image of her dead son was before her, and her daughter nearly dead in the same way. What if he had merely closed their throats as he had just closed hers? She might never have known for sure. He might have gotten away with it. She ripped his throat out. He was dying when she gave way to her own pain. He was too far gone to hurt her any more. He died with soft, bubbling noises and much bleeding as she lay across him reviving herself, mending herself. She was hungry. Great God, she was hungry. The smell of blood filled her nostrils as she restored her normal breathing ability, and the smell and the flesh beneath her tormented her. She got up quickly and loped down the narrow stairs, down the main stairs. There, she hesitated. She wanted food before she changed again. She was sick with hunger now. She would be mad with it if she had to change to order food. Louisa came into the house, saw her, and stopped. The old woman was not afraid of her. There was none of that teasing fear smell to make her change swiftly before she lost her head.
"Is he dead?"
the old woman asked. Anyanwu lowered her cat head in what she hoped would be taken for a nod.
"Good riddance," Louisa said. "Are you hungry?"
Two more quick nods.
"Go into the dining room. I'll bring food."
She went through the house and out toward the kitchen. She was a good, steady, sensible friend. She did more than sewing for her keep. Anyanwu would have kept her if she had done nothing at all, but she was so old, over 70. Soon, some frailty that Anyanwu could not make a medicine for would take her life, and another friend would be gone. People were temporary. So temporary. Disobeying orders, Iye and Helen came in through the front door and saw Anyanwu, still bloody from her kill, and not yet gone to the dining room. If not for the presence of the child, Anyanwu would have roared her anger and discomfort at Iye. She did not like having her children see her at such a time. She loped away down the hall to the dining room. Iye stayed where she was, but allowed Helen to follow Anyanwu. Anyanwu, struggling with fear smell, blood smell, hunger, and anger, did not notice the child until they were both in the dining room. There, wearily, Anyanwu lay down on a rug before the cold fireplace. Fearlessly, the child came to sit on the rug beside her. Anyanwu looked up, knowing that her face was smeared with blood and wishing she had cleaned herself before she came downstairs. Cleaned herself and left her daughter in the care of someone more reliable. Helen stroked her, fingered her spots, caressed her as though she were a large house cat. Like most children born on the plantation, she had seen Anyanwu change her shape many times. She was as accepting of the leopard now as she had been of the black dog. And the white man named Warwick, who had to put in an occasional appearance for the sake of the neighbors. Somehow, under the child's hands, Anyanwu began to relax. After a while, she began to purr.
"Agu,"
the little girl said softly. This was one of the few words of Anyanwu's language Helen knew. It meant simply, leopard.
"Agu,"
she repeated.
"Be this way for Doro. He wouldn't dare hurt us while you're this way."
Chapter 13. Doro returned a month after Joseph Toller's grisly corpse had been buried in the weed patch that had once been a slave's graveyard, and Stephen Ifeyinwa Mbada had been buried in ground that had once been set aside for the master and his family. Joseph would be very lonely in his slave plot. No one else had been buried as a slave since Anyanwu bought the plantation. Doro arrived knowing through his special senses that both Joseph and Stephen were dead. He arrived with replacements, two boy children no older than Helen. He arrived unannounced and walked through the front door as though he owned the house. Anyanwu, unaware of his presence, was in the library writing out a list of supplies needed for the plantation. So much was purchased now instead of homemade. Soap, ordinary cloth, candles, even some medicines purchased ready-made could be trusted, though sometimes not for the purposes their makers intended. And of course, new tools were needed. Two mules had died and three others were old and would soon need replacing. Field hands needed shoes, hats. It was cheaper to have people working in the fields bringing in large harvests than it was to have them making things that could be bought cheaply elsewhere. That was especially important here, where there were no slaves, where people were paid for their work and supplied with decent housing and good food. It cost more to keep people decently. If Anyanwu had not been a good manager, she would have had to return to the sea much more often for the wearisome task of finding and robbing sunken vessels, then carrying away gold and precious stones, usually within her own body. She was adding a long column of figures when Doro entered with the two little boys. She turned at the sound of his footsteps and saw a pale, lean, angular man with lank black hair and two fingers missing from the hand he used to lower himself into the armchair near her desk.
"It's me," he said wearily. "Order us a meal, would you? We haven't had a decent one for some time."
How courteous of him to ask her to give the order, she thought bitterly. Just then, one of her daughters came to the door, stopped, and looked at Doro with alarm. Anyanwu was in her youthful female shape, after all, but Edward Warwick was known to have a handsome, educated black mistress.
"We'll be having supper early,"
Anyanwu told the girl.
"Have Rita get whatever she can ready as quickly as possible."
The girl vanished obediently, playing her role as a maid, not knowing the white stranger was only Doro. Anyanwu stared at Doro's latest body, wanting to scream at him, order him out of her house. It was because of him that her son was dead. He had let the snake loose among her children, and what had he brought with him this time? Young snakes? God, she longed to be rid of him.
"Did they kill each other?"
Doro asked her, and the two little boys looked at him wide-eyed. If they were not young snakes, he would teach them to crawl. Clearly he did not care what was said before them. She ignored Doro.
"Are you hungry now?"
she asked the boys. One nodded, a little shy.
"I am,"
the other said quickly.
"Come with me then,"
she said.
"Rita will give you bread and a peach preserve."
She noticed that they did not look to Doro for permission to leave. They jumped up, followed her, and ran out to the kitchen when she pointed it out to them. Rita would not be pleased. It was enough, surely, to ask her to rush supper. But she would feed the children, and perhaps send them to Louisa until Anyanwu called for them. Sighing, Anyanwu went back to Doro.
"You are always one to overprotect children," he commented.
"I only allow them to be children for as long as they will," she said. "They will grow up and learn of sorrow and evil quickly enough."
"Tell me about Stephen and Joseph."
She went to her desk, sat down, and wondered whether she could discuss this calmly with him. She had wept and cursed him so many times, but neither weeping nor cursing would move him.
"Why did you bring me a man without telling me what he could do?"
she asked quietly.
"What did he do?"
Anyanwu told him everything, and ended with the same falsely calm question.
Why did you bring me a man without telling me what he could do?
Call Margaret, Doro said, ignoring her question. Margaret was the daughter who had married Joseph.
Why?
Because when I brought Joseph here, he couldn't do anything, not anything. He was just good breeding stock with the potential to father useful children. He must have had a transition in spite of his age, and he must have had it here.
I would have known. I'm called here whenever anyone is sick, and there were no signs that he was approaching transition.
Get Margaret. Let's talk to her. Anyanwu did not want to call the girl. Margaret had suffered more than anyone over the killings, had lost both the beautiful, worthless husband she had loved and the younger brother she had adored. She had not even a child to console her. Joseph had not managed to make her pregnant. In the months since his and Stephen's death, the girl had become gaunt and solemn. She had always been a lively girl who talked too much and laughed and kept people around her amused. Now, she hardly spoke at all. She was literally sick with grief. Recently, Helen had taken to sleeping with her and following her around during the day, helping her with her work or merely keeping her company. Anyanwu had watched this warily at first, thinking that Margaret might resent Helen as the cause of Joseph's trouble. Margaret was not in the most rational of moods, but this was clearly not the case.
"She's getting better,"
Helen told Anyanwu confidentially.
"She was by herself too much before."
The little girl possessed an interesting combination of ruthlessness, kindness, and keen perception. Anyanwu hoped desperately Doro would never notice her, but the older girl was painfully vulnerable, and now Doro meant to tear open wounds that had only just begun to heal.
"Let her alone for a while, Doro. This has hurt her more than it's hurt anyone else."
"Call her, Anyanwu, or I will." Loathing him, Anyanwu went to find Margaret. The girl did not work in the fields as some of Anyanwu's children did. Thus, she was nearby. She was in the washhouse, sweating and ironing a dress. Helen was with her, sprinkling and rolling other clothing.
"Leave that for a while,"
Anyanwu told Margaret.
"Come in with me."
"What is it?"
Margaret asked. She put one iron down to heat and, without thinking, picked up another.
"Doro,"
Anyanwu said softly. Margaret froze, holding the heavy iron motionless and upright in the air. Anyanwu took it from her hand and put it down on the bricks of the hearth, far from the fire. She moved the other two irons away from where they were heating.
"Don't try to iron anything," she told Helen. "I have enough of a bill for cloth now."
Helen said nothing, only watched as Anyanwu led Margaret away. Outside the washhouse, Margaret began to tremble.
"What does he want with me? Why can't he leave us alone?"
"He will never leave us alone,"
Anyanwu said flatly. Margaret blinked, looked at Anyanwu.
"What shall I do?"
"Answer his questions, all of them, even if they are personal and offensive. Answer, and tell him the truth."
"He scares me."
"Good. There is very much to fear.
Answer him and obey him. Leave any criticizing or disagreeing with him to me."
There was silence until just before they reached the house. Then Margaret said,
"We're your weakness, aren't we? You could outrun him for 100 more years, if not for us."
"I've never been content without my own around me,"
Anyanwu said. She met the girl's light brown eyes.
"Why do you think I have all these children? I could have husbands and wives and lovers into the next century and never have a child. Why should I have so many, except that I want them and love them? If they were burdens too heavy for me, they would not be here. You would not be here. But he uses us to make you obey. I know he does.
He does. That's his way."
She touched the smooth, red-brown skin of the girl's face.
Neka, none of this should concern you. Go and tell him what he wants to hear, then forget about him. I have endured him before. I will survive.
You'll survive until the world ends,
said the girl solemnly.
You and him.
She shook her head. They went into the house together, and to the library where they found Doro sitting at Anyanwu's desk, looking through her records.
For God's sake,
Anyanwu said with disgust. He looked up. You're a better businesswoman than I thought, with your views against slavery, he said. To her amazement, the praise reached her. She was not pleased that he had gone snooping through her things, but she was abruptly less annoyed. She went to the desk and stood over him silently until he smiled, got up, and took his armchair again. Margaret took another chair and sat waiting.
Did you tell her?
Doro asked Anyanwu. Anyanwu shook her head. He faced Margaret.
We think Joseph may have undergone transition while he was here. Did he show any signs of it?
Margaret had been watching Doro's new face, but as he said the word transition, she looked away, studied the pattern of the oriental rug.
Tell me about it, said Doro quietly.
How could he have? Demanded Anyanwu. There was no sign.
He knew what was happening,
Margaret whispered.
I knew, too, because I saw it happen to Stephen. It took much longer with Stephen, though. For Joe, it came almost all at once. He was feeling bad for a week, maybe a little more, but nobody noticed except me. He made me promise not to tell anyone. Then one night when he'd been here for about a month, he went through the worst of it. I thought he would die, but he begged me not to leave him alone or tell anyone.
Why?
Anyanwu demanded.
I could have helped you with him. You're not strong. He must have hurt you.
Margaret nodded.
He did. But he was afraid of you. He thought you would tell Doro.
It wouldn't have made much sense for her not to, Doro said.
Margaret continued to stare at the rug.
Finish, Doro ordered.
She wet her lips.
He was afraid. He said you killed his brother when his brother's transition ended.
There was silence. Anyanwu looked from Margaret to Doro.
Did you do it?
She asked, frowning.
Yes. I thought that might be the trouble.
But his brother? Why, Doro?
His brother went mad during transition. He was like a lesser version of Nweke. In his pain and confusion, he killed the man who was helping him. I reached him before he could accidentally kill himself, and I took him. I got 5 children by his body before I had to give it up.
Couldn't you have helped him?
Anyanwu asked.
Wouldn't he have come back to his senses if you had given him time?
He attacked me, Anyanwu. Salvageable people don't do that.
But
he was mad. He would have attacked anyone who approached him. He would have wiped out his family if I hadn't been there.
Doro leaned back and wet his lips, and Anyanwu remembered what he had done to his own family so long ago. He had told her that terrible story. I'm not a healer, he said softly. I save life in the only way I can.
I had not thought you bothered to save it at all,
Anyanwu said bitterly. He looked at her. Your son is dead, he said. I'm sorry. He would have been a fine man. I would never have brought Joseph here if I had known they would be dangerous to each other. He seemed utterly sincere. She could not recall the last time she had heard him apologize for anything. She stared at him, confused.
Joe didn't say anything about his brother going crazy,
Margaret said.
Joseph didn't live with his family, Doro said. He couldn't get along with them, so I found foster parents for him.
Oh.
Margaret looked away, seeming to understand, to accept. No more than half the children on the plantation lived with their parents. Margaret? She looked up at him, then quickly looked down again. He was being remarkably gentle with her, but she was still afraid. Are you pregnant? He asked.
I wish I were,
she whispered. She was beginning to cry. All right, Doro said. All right, that's all. She got up quickly and left the room. When she was gone, Anyanwu said, Doro, Joseph was too old for a transition. Everything you taught me says he was too old. He was 24. I haven't seen anyone change at that age before, but... He hesitated, changed direction. You never asked about his ancestry, Anyanwu.
I never wanted to know.
You do know. He's your descendant, of course. She made herself shrug.
You said you would bring my grandchildren.
He was the grandchild of your grandchildren. Both his parents traced their descent back to you.
Why do you tell me that now? I don't want to know any more about it. He's dead.
He's Isaac's descendant, too. Doro continued relentlessly. People of Isaac's line are sometimes a little late going into transition, though Joseph is about as late as I've seen. The two children I've brought to you are sons of his brother's body.
No!
Anyanwu stared at him.
Take them away. I want no more of that kind near me.
You have them. Teach them and guide them as you do your own children. I told you your descendants would not be easy to care for. You chose to care for them anyway. She said nothing. He made it sound as though her choice had been free, as though he had not coerced her into choosing. If I had found you earlier, I would have brought them to you when they were even younger, he said. Since I didn't, you'll have to do what you can with them now. Teach them responsibility, pride, honor. Teach them whatever you taught Stephen. But don't be foolish enough to teach them you believe they'll grow up to be criminals. They'll be powerful men someday, and they're liable to fulfill your expectations. Either way. Still, she said nothing. What was there for her to say or do? He would be obeyed, or he would make her life and her children's lives not worth living, if he did not kill them outright. You have 5 to 10 years before the boys transitions, he said. They will have transitions. I'm as sure as I can be of that. Their ancestry is just right.
Are they mine, or will you interfere with them?
Until their transitions, they are yours.
And then?
I'll breed them, of course.
Of course. Let them marry and stay here. If they fit here, they'll want to stay. How can they become responsible men if their only future is to be bred?
Doro laughed aloud, opening his mouth wide to show the empty spaces of several missing teeth. Do you hear yourself, woman? First you want no part of them. Now you don't want to let go of them even when they're grown. She waited silently until he stopped laughing, then asked,
Do you think I'm willing to throw away any child, Doro? If there is a chance for those boys to grow up better than Joseph, why shouldn't I try to give them that chance? If, when they grow up, they can be men instead of dogs who know nothing except how to climb onto one female after another, why shouldn't I try to help?
He sobered. I knew you would help, and not grudgingly. Don't you think I know you by now, Anyanwu? Oh, he knew her, knew how to use her.
Will you do it, then? Let them marry and stay here if they fit?
Yes. She looked down, examining the rug pattern that had held so much of Margaret's attention.
Will you take them away if they don't fit? Can't fit? Like Joseph?
Yes, he repeated. Their seed is too valuable to be wasted. He thought of nothing else, nothing. Shall I stay with you for a while, Anyanwu? She stared at him in surprise, and he looked back, neutral-faced, waiting for an answer. Was he asking a real question, then?
Will you go if I ask you to?
Yes. Yes. He was saying that so often now, being so gentle and cooperative, for him. He had come courting again.
Go,
she said as gently as she could.
Your presence is disruptive here, Doro. You frighten my people.
Now, let him keep his word. He shrugged, nodded.
Tomorrow morning, he said.
And the next morning, he was gone. Perhaps an hour after his departure, Helen and Luisa came hand in hand to Anyanwu to tell her that Margaret had hanged herself from a beam in the washhouse. For a time after Margaret's death, Anyanwu felt a sickness that she could not dispel. Grief. Two children lost so close together. Somehow, she never got used to losing children, especially young children, children it seemed had been with her for only a few moments. How many had she buried now? At the funeral, the two little boys Doro had brought saw her crying and came to take her hands and stand with her solemnly. They seemed to be adopting her as mother and Luisa as grandmother. They were fitting in surprisingly well, but Anyanwu found herself wondering how long they would last.
Go to the sea, Luisa told her when she would not eat, when she became more and more listless. The sea cleanses you. I have seen it. Go and be a fish for a while.
I'm all right,
Anyanwu said automatically. Luisa swept that aside with a sound of disgust.
You are not all right. You are acting like the child you appear to be. Get away from here for a while. Give yourself a rest, and us a rest from you.
The words startled Anyanwu out of her listlessness.
A rest from me?
Those of us who can feel your pain, as you feel it, need a rest from you.
Anyanwu blinked. Her mind had been elsewhere. Of course, the people who took comfort in her desire to protect them and keep them together, people who took pleasure in her pleasure, would also suffer pain when she suffered.
I'll go,
she told Luisa. The old woman smiled.
It will be good for you.
Anyanwu sent for one of her white daughters to bring her husband and children for a visit. They were not needed or wanted to run the plantation, and they knew it. That was why Anyanwu trusted them to take her place for a while. They could fit in without taking over. They had their own strangenesses. The woman, Leah, was like Denise, her mother, taking impressions from houses and pieces of furniture, from rocks, trees, and human flesh, seeing ghosts of things that had happened in the past. Anyanwu warned her to keep out of the washhouse. The front of the main house where Stephen had died was hard enough on her. She learned quickly where she should not step, what she should not touch if she did not want to see her brother climbing the railing, diving off head first. The husband, Kane, was sensitive enough to see occasionally into Leah's thoughts and know that she was not insane, or at least no more insane than he. He was a quadroon whose white father had educated him, cared for him, and unfortunately died without freeing him, leaving him in the hands of his father's wife. He had run away, escaped just ahead of the slave dealer, and left Texas for Louisiana, where he calmly used all his father had taught him to pass as a well-bred young white man. He had said nothing about his background until he began to understand how strange his wife's family was. He still did not fully understand, but he loved Leah. He could be himself with her without alarming her in any way. He was comfortable with her. To keep that comfort, he accepted without understanding. He could come now and then to live on a plantation that would run itself without his supervision and enjoy the company of Anyanwu's strange collection of misfits. He felt right at home.
What's this about your going to sea?
He asked Anyan Wu. He got along well with her as long as she kept her Warwick identity. Otherwise, she made him nervous. He could not accept the idea that his wife's father could become a woman. In fact, had been born a woman. For him, Anyan Wu wore the thin, elderly Warwick guise.
I need to go away from here for a while, she said.
Where will you go this time?
To find the nearest school of dolphins.
She smiled at him. The thought of going to sea again had made her able to smile. During her years of hiding, she had not only spent a great deal of time as a large dog or a bird, but she had left home often to swim free as a dolphin. She had done it first to confuse and evade Doro, then to get wealth and buy land, and finally because she enjoyed it. The freedom of the sea eased worry, gave her time to think through confusion, took away boredom. She wondered what Doro did when he was bored. Kill?
You'll fly to open water, won't you?
Kane asked.
Fly and run. Sometimes it's safer to run.
Christ, he muttered. I thought I'd gotten over envying you.
She was eating as he spoke, eating what would probably be her last cooked meal for some time. Rice and stew, baked yams, cornbread, strong coffee, wine, and fruit. Her children complained that she ate like a poor woman, but she ignored them. She was content. Now she looked up at Kane through her blue, white man's eyes.
If you're not afraid, she said, when I come back, I'll try to share the experience with you.
He shook his head.
I don't have the control. Stephen used to be able to share things with me, both of us working together, but me alone.
He shrugged. There was an uncomfortable silence. Then Anyan Wu pushed back from the table.
I'm leaving now,
she said abruptly. She went upstairs to her bedroom, where she undressed, opened her door to the upper gallery of the porch, took her bird shape, and flew away. More than a month passed before she flew back, eagle-shaped, but larger than any eagle, refreshed by the sea and the air, and ravenous because in her eagerness to see home again, she had not stopped often enough to hunt. She circled first to see that there were no visitors, strangers to be startled and perhaps to shoot her. She had been shot 3 times this trip. That was enough. When she had satisfied herself that it was safe, she came down into the grassy open space 3/4 enclosed by the house, its dependencies, and her people's cabins. 2 little children saw her and ran into the kitchen. Seconds later, they were back, each tugging at one of Rita's hands. Rita walked over to Anyan Wu, looked at her, and said with no doubt at all in her voice,
I suppose you're hungry.
Anyan Wu flapped her wings. Rita laughed.
You make a fine, handsome bird. I wonder how you would look on a dining room table.
Rita had always had a strange sense of humor. Anyan Wu flapped her wings again impatiently, and Rita went back to the kitchen and brought her 2 rabbits, skinned, cleaned, ready for cooking. Anyan Wu held them with her feet and tore into them, glad Rita had not gotten around to cooking them. As she ate, a black man came out of the house, Helen at his side. The man was a stranger, some local freedman perhaps, or even a runaway. Anyan Wu always did what she could for runaways, either feeding and clothing them and sending them on their way, better equipped to survive, or, on those rare occasions when one seemed to fit into the house, buying him. This was a compact, handsome little black man, not much bigger than Anyan Wu was in her true form. She raised her head and looked at him with interest. If this one had a mind to match his body, she might buy him even if he did not fit. It had been too long since she had had a husband. Occasional lovers ceased to satisfy her after a while. She went back to tearing at the rabbits unselfconsciously, as her daughter and the stranger watched. When she finished, she wiped her beak on the grass, gave the attractive stranger a final glance, and flew heavily around to the upper gallery outside her room. There, comfortably full, she dozed for a while, giving her